Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. This is our first show of the new year, and I'd like to ring in 2026 doing something I started for our first show in 2025. It's an audio retrospective of last year's interviews on Jonesy, which I call Beginnings, for the beginning of the new year and the fact we're playing only the beginnings, the first few minutes of the interviews, and meshing them all together, kind of Terry Gross meets William S. Burroughs. And we do it chronologically, from our first interview last January to our final interview of 2025 just a few weeks ago. Here's the guest list in order of appearance. Sarah Neidhart and Wendy McPhee, Jeremy Braddock and David Osman, Karen Russell, Elizabeth Heider, Laura Stanfill, Elaine Pagels, Nancy Townsley, Miriam Gershow, Lydia Yuknovich, John Raymond, Mo Davio, Lainey Zumas, Gigi Little, Brandon Wong, and Amy Mason Doan. And I enjoyed talking with all of them. So please join me for Beginnings, a look back at the past year on Jonesy and a prelude of things to come in the new one, which is already in progress. 20 Acres, a 70s childhood in the woods with author Sarah Neidhart and her mom, Wendy McPhee, 1-23-25. Well, Sarah and Wendy, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios. It's a treat to have you both here to talk about Sarah's book.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Sarah, let's start with you. Most of 20 Acres takes place in a small, somewhat isolated town, Fox, Arkansas,
yes,
where you spent a good part of your childhood. But it got its start here in Portland, your current home, when you began going through an archive of family,
yes,
letters, photographs, audio cassettes. How'd you gather all the material?
Well, I knew my mother had them. I'd seen them when we all lived in California a little bit. I'd seen some stray things here in a drawer. They weren't very well organized for a time. I knew there was maybe some envelopes that she had with a bunch more in it. But it wasn't until she moved to Portland and I started really going through the letters. I decided I want to read all these. I want to gather them all together. And when I started really reading them all sequentially and then I transcribed them, then that's when
I
knew I had something
more. How many letters were that? Hundreds?
I think there are about 100 letters.
Wow.
Probably.
That's a lot of background work there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
When looking through the collection, what inspired you to turn it all into a book?
I already had been kind of playing with the idea of a book about this story. I had taken a nonfiction class in California and kind of written some essays on it. But I hadn't really been able to take it very far beyond sort of some unformed essays. But when I read the letters and sort of sequentially rather than just sort of one here and one there, I really saw a story arc. And that's when I knew, oh, I can combine all these memories and thoughts that I've been accumulating with all these letters and some other archival documents, or not documents, but we had some audio cassettes from that time. And that's when I knew I had enough to turn it into a book. And that's when I really dedicated myself to doing that.
And you've said that you started writing the book when your son started kindergarten. That was around 2013. So that was just, you had more time.
I just suddenly had more time. Project. And that's when I really stopped just playing at it here and there and really started dedicating lots of time to it.
Fire Sign, the electromagnetic history of everything, as told on 9 comedy albums with author Jeremy Braddock and Fire Sign David Osman, 2-13-25. Jeremy and David, thanks for joining us by Zoom today. Jeremy from back east where he teaches at Cornell and David from his home on Whidbey Island.
That's right. We are Pacific time and Eastern time
and everything in between.
Yeah.
Now, Jeremy, you wrote on your Substack recently, here's something I wish I had more of, walking through the Fire Sign Theater's voluminous, amazing archive with David Osman. So I know it's a thrill for both of us to have David here walking through our discussion of your book.
Sure is.
And you're a Fire Sign Theater fan, or Firehead, as we're sometimes called. When did you first hear about the Fire Signs? I read that it was through your uncle when you were 12 years old.
I think around 12, I had an uncle who was of the original fire sign listening generation, lives in Eugene, Oregon, and he started giving my brother and me fire sign records, yeah, when I was about 12 or 13. So I really came of age listening to them and never stopped, but there was always a lot more to know.
Do you remember the first one you listened to?
I don't remember for sure. I think he actually may have given me the EP, the Nick Danger EP, Case of the Missing Shoe, which I think probably had just been released around then. But he did give us How Can You Be in Two Places at Once, Don't Crush That Dwarf, and In the Next World, You're on Your Own. Those we all had pretty early.
And as a 12-year-old, what were you thinking of the fire signs? I mean, a very different kind of comedy.
Yeah, for sure. A really different kind of comedy. I mean, my parents were Monty Python fans, so there was a point of reference there. And they also had a record collection, so we were used to, growing, sitting in front of the stereo and putting on an album and
Watching it
listening
go round and
carefully.
round while you listen.
Yeah, exactly. And then listening again. And there's all different levels of comedy on fire sign albums. So there's plenty of puerile jokes that are super funny, but a 12 or 13-year-old would really gravitate towards. But at the same time, it was also obvious that there was an amazing intelligence behind the records, and like I said, always more to know. And I really do think that listening to the records shaped the way I thought about culture. It made me want to read more, and both to work creatively and critically in my thinking about Fire Sign, but in my thinking about the world generally. So thanks, David.
You're welcome. We're on the rubber yellow line.
Karen Russell, author of The Antidote, 2:27:25. Karen, I'm so happy you're here. We first talked for your story collection, Orange World, in May 2019, and many times since then on and off the mic. And you shared updates on the novel you were working on, how challenging it was to write, how long it was taking. Well, I have it here now in my hands, and I'm in awe of how good it is. But you must feel a great sense of relief. That's 16 years in the making.
I feel a tremendous sense of relief, and also it's very surreal that you really did read it and that it's sitting here on the table, Ken. I really did get the idea for this when I was finishing my first novel in 2009, and I tried and failed to write it several times. I went through a valley of the shadow where I thought I was a story writer, and novels just weren't something that I would try to write again. And so I guess that's the silver lining, is just the fact that it exists feels like tremendously relieving and surprising.
Yeah, but you were so productive during that time. Two story collections, a novella, numerous works of fiction and nonfiction, also dance and musical theater production, The Night Falls. And all that time, even though you put the book aside, it was calling you back.
We were speaking about hauntings, and I was entirely haunted by this book for a long time. And thank you for that catalog. It's funny, I do sort of feel like aware that, I have written story collections and this shorter, a short novel or novella. But a lot of the press so far has sort of been like, second novel after 14, whatever, to over a decade hiatus. And it
Yeah,
sort of makes me
what a
feel like I came
slacker.
out of a coma or something, I was like, wait, I've been around. I've been doing some verbs,
Well, those were pretty good books, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, Orange World, well, even the musical production, which I haven't seen, but I wish I could.
Oh,
I think it
thanks,
just played in one
Ken.
location for a while, but hopefully it was videoed, or we'll get to see it. Now, I'd like to start from the beginning. There was this great profile on you recently in Poets and Writers by Brian Gresko, and I looked that up. He's been covering you for
Forever.
15 years, and he says in the profile, according to you, the book was born in a single image of a woman holding, quote, a sparkling emerald green horn to her ear. Did that image just appear to you,
It
like in a
did.
dream, or?
It did. I mean, and it's hard to totally, this is so long ago now, but I was finishing my first novel, Swamplandia, and I just did. I got this idea of, but it was really an image of a woman holding one of these antique ear horns. I mean, people, I realize from talking about this book that no one knows what that is. But, I've seen these funnels in old movies, right?
You see that in movies of the 30s and 40s. Right. What was that again, young man? Exactly.
It looks almost like a gramophone horn or like some beautiful, you know, metal seashell or something. And somebody was whispering a secret into this. And I was like, oh, I see. Like, she's like a human vault. She's like a memory bank. This person's whispering something that they really can't bear to remember, and it's going to funnel into her body, and she'll store it there for this person. So that was sort of the
Wow, all that from that one image.
I think I knew it would be about like a collapse of memory, right? Like these women, I called them prairie witches who store memories for people. I'm not sure what to say about that, Ken. As you know, I like just love to literalize these things that are very abstract. So sleep donation people, you know, there's a nightmare contagion. People could donate dreams to one another. I think maybe being a fiction writer sort of predisposes you to think about memories and dreams in this way because you are always materially exchanging them with readers. You know, like writing and reading feels very much like a transfer of memory between bodies, right?
Elizabeth Heider, author of May the Wolf Die, 3/27/25.
Elizabeth, first I have to say that I read May the Wolf Die over the holidays after seeing it listed as the Washington Post Best Mystery of 2024, and I loved it. As you know, I told you all about it. I got in touch with you and practically begged for this interview, so thank you for saying yes.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I was really excited to be here.
And May the Wolf Die is your first published novel, which amazes me considering how good it is. But you've had that writing bug for a long time, going back to when you were 8 years old.
Yeah, ever since I can remember. Yeah, I've been writing my whole life. So when I was 8 years old, my mother took my sister and I to a adult learning, you know, ongoing learning creative writing class in the evenings at a local high school, taught by Lofton Harvey, who was an English teacher at Bingham High School. And he was wonderful. And we went there for years. And so we would bring our little stories that we'd written over the week, and we would, you know, go around the group and read out loud and get feedback. And it was just such a wonderful, nurturing experience. And then Lofton ended up being an English teacher for me when I went to high school. And he was just a wonderful advocate and a wonderful friend. And we're still in touch. So it was a great experience. So yeah, I've been writing my whole life, and this is definitely not the first book I've written.
Now, you grew up in South Jordan, Utah, and you've said, quote, your family were all unrepentant bibliophiles. I wonder what you were reading at the time, maybe books that inspired you to write your own stories?
Oh my gosh. I mean, my parents just had books all over the house. I mean, they would get them used, cheap, whatever. I mean, they set up really rudimentary bookshelves everywhere. So I just read whatever I could get my hands on. So a lot of classics, actually. My mother really was a fan of the classics. And so some of my favorite books when I was like 12 years old were, you know, Jane Eyre and The Count of Monte Cristo and Sherlock Holmes and, you know, Jane Austen's books. So it was just a wonderful environment to just indulge as much as possible.
Now, you graduated high school at the age of 16 and enrolled in the University of Utah's actor training program. So a year of theater studies, and you performed and worked by great playwrights, Shakespeare, Chekhov, David Mamet. Why acting as the next step? Why not a program in creative writing?
I just got the acting bug when I was in high school. So I did Shakespeare there. I did a number of different plays and competitions, and I had a group of friends I really loved, and I loved to act. And so it was a great experience. And so I auditioned for this conservatoire program at the University of Utah and got in, and it was a kind of an elite group of kids, and I loved it. I mean, I kept writing. I don't think it occurred to me to like go take classes in creative writing. I think I just did it, you know, and then I acted. So that was the first year of college.
Laura Stanfill, author of Imagine a Door, A Guidebook for Writers, 4/10/25.
Laura, it's so good to talk with you again for the show. The last time was for the release of your novel, Singing Lessons for the Stylish Canary. That was almost 3 years ago to the day.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, that novel, by the way, your first published novel, plays an important part in the writing of your newest book, Imagine a Door. You started that novel in 2007 and had been working on it for 15 years before publishing it in 2022. You founded Forest Avenue Press in 2012. So in your professional life, writer precedes publisher. In fact, you go way back as a writer to your childhood.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was writing books in grade school back in the day, and I grew up wanting to be a writer. I think I knew I wanted to be a writer in second grade. So,
and you had teachers that encouraged you.
I sure did. I all the way through, I found teachers who understood what writing meant to me and recognized that I had a skill in that area, and then they encouraged me.
And you even have some of their reports in this book, which must be in your parents' voluminous Laura archive.
Yes, I'm an only child, so there is a massive archive of all of my old report cards and stories and poems and doodles. Yeah.
So going way back as a writer, you were first introduced to others in the Portland literary community as a writer. And you were a member of several workshops, including the Pinewood Table, which is led by Stephen Allred and Joanna Rose, whose own books you later published with Forest Avenue. Was that around that time you started writing singing lessons for the Stylish Canary?
It was actually earlier. I moved to Portland in 2001, and I believe I joined the Pinewood Table the first time in 2002. I moved to the beach for 2 years and left and then came back
again. You were
again.
A journalist there?
Yes, exactly.
Was that in Cannon Beach?
No, that was in Lincoln City.
Ah.
Yeah.
And as a writer working on your own, what was it like to become part of these writing groups, part of this community of fellow writers? And you talk a lot about community in the new book.
Well, when I first got here, I knew I needed to find people who were doing the same work of writing as me just to connect and to feel like I belonged here. And so I started a writing group at Annie Bloom's upstairs in their little office area. And people showed up. People came and they joined my writing group and they shared their work and we talked about it. And one of the people who came was Steve Arndt.
The connector.
The connector, yes. Steve Arndt.
He's such a great guy. And by connector, I mean that he's always introducing people to other people. And they make their own connections, and it just grows from there. But he's so good at that and
exactly.
Very generous.
He was definitely the foundation of my finding community here. He told me about Stephen and Joanna and the Pinewood Table, and then he drove me over to a class to let me experience their teaching. And then I was like, I am in. I want to learn from these writers. And it taught me so much about being a writer in terms of the craft, but it also taught me what it was like to sit in community with writers who have very different voices and styles and subject matters.
Elaine Pagels, author of Miracles and Wonder, The Historical Mystery of Jesus, 4:24-25.
Elaine, thanks for joining us today, especially after a hectic day of travel. The new book's subtitle is The Historical Mystery of Jesus, and a big part of that mystery is his crucifixion and resurrection. So it's appropriate we're talking on Good Friday a few days before Easter Sunday.
Yes, it's good to talk with you.
I want to first say I read Miracles and Wonder along with your previous book, Why Religion, A Personal Story, which came out in 2018, so about 7 years ago. That was somewhat of a memoir and provides a lot of context for the new book and a lot of context, I think, for our conversation. So I hope you don't mind if I go back and forth, maybe conflating the two at times, like the two books are kind of conflated in my mind.
Well, that's fine. I never thought I'd really publish that one because it was so personal. But then I thought, well, why not? It's just somebody's life, you know?
Oh, I found it added a lot of context to your own beliefs and your own writings and your own scholarly research.
It does. I mean, I think research that doesn't engage someone powerfully for certain whatever reasons are doesn't matter much.
So we'll start kind of early in your life. You grew up the daughter of a Stanford professor in what you call, quote, Palo Alto's suburban cocoon. I went to school there, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And though your father was raised Presbyterian, he was not religion, kind of adamantly against religion, I think.
Yes, he turned against it when he discovered Darwin. He just thought, okay, good. Now I can jettison all that nonsense and get to the real stuff, which is obsessive science.
Right. And you yourself, you soured early on the Methodist Church, which I think you attended in Palo Alto. you thought it replaced a passion for social justice with an emphasis on being nice. By nice, do you mean kind of obedient, don't make waves, don't cause trouble?
Well, it was just sort of, you know, the message was be a good person, be nice to people. I mean, that's not a bad message.
Oh, no.
It's that the power that had started Methodism was about reaching out to the issues in the world, about in society. And that made it very powerful initially. And you just didn't get that. I mean, here Jesus is, you know, has long blonde hair and blue eyes, and he's got children on his lap, and that's kind of the picture.
Right, and of course, historically, that's just not the case, which you know very well.
But he's not the Jesus of Mark's gospel.
No, oh no, and that's in the book. And you yourself, early on, you had a passion for the arts, dance, poetry, music, things you weren't finding in religion at the time, but all that changed in high school. You went with friends to see the evangelist Billy Graham, a very charismatic evangelist, in San Francisco at Candlestick Park. Yes. And that kind of changed things.
I didn't even know who he was. You know, I just thought, hey, we're going to San Francisco. And there were, you know, 18,000 people in the stadium there. And 6,000 in the parking lot who couldn't get in. And the roads were packed for miles in every direction. It was a very big deal. And to my surprise, I found it very powerful and very compelling. And so I just went right into it. When the altar call came and you can have a whole new life and you can be born again and you can start all over, I just thought, that is for me. And I was very moved, and I went down and gave my heart to Jesus. And it was a powerful experience.
And giving your heart to Jesus, that's when you joined an evangelical church in Palo Alto,
yes,
which appealed to you at first, up until a close high school friend, Paul, died in a car accident. Paul was Jewish. You told the church members and you didn't get much sympathy.
No, I was so shocked. I mean, these are people I knew really well. And I said, you know, my friend just died was he born again? And when I said, no, he was Jewish, they said, well, then he's in hell. And I was totally stopped. And I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach and I couldn't speak. And I just walked out, never went back.
Nancy Townsley, author of Sunshine Girl, 5825. Well, Nancy, welcome to KABU, where I spent my brief career in journalism, co-anchoring a few evening newscasts. Of course, your career in journalism lasted a lot longer, 38 years, from the age of 21 to your retirement at the age of 59. Now, you majored in journalism at Oregon State University, and the reason you chose this field of study, or certainly one of the main reasons, goes back to your senior year in high school.
It does, Ken.
And a teacher plays a big part. Huh?
Yeah, a very special teacher. And she's no longer with us, but Mrs. Letty Owings, just a superb human being and a wonderful teacher, the kind of teacher who has high expectations because she knows what her students are capable of, but also was very compassionate. Letty Owings, when she left Lake Ridge High School, went on to become the executive at Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and she also started the Letty Owings House for pregnant women who had addiction, and it was a recovery program. So she was wonderful. And what she did for me particularly was she wrote in the margin of one of my report cards, back when we had, you know, paper report cards, that I had a flair for writing, and I really took that to heart. This was 1974 or 75.
And nobody had told you that before.
Well, you know, I mean, a few people might have alluded to, hey, I like what you write. But Mrs. Owings meant more than that. She meant you could probably make a career out of this.
Wow.
And so that was impressive to me. I was very much an admirer of hers. And so I decided, okay, what could I do as a writer? Well, I could become a journalist. And so that's what led me to studying journalism in college.
Now, right after graduation, you got your first job as a professional journalist at the Newburgh Graphic.
It's true, I did.
And you described that as a ma and pa owned rural weekly paper. Yes. I guess there aren't too many of those left, unfortunately.
Right.
And Nancy, you were hired as their sports editor, though you didn't have much experience writing about or even playing sports. You were a cheerleader in high school, and you went to a few Beaver games,
that's
football games
at
Oregon State. But the news editor at the Graphic, again, you got this like Letty Owens, his name, J. Michael Fagan, he saw potential, and he convinced the publisher to hire you. Take a shot.
Yes, he did. I still remember the meeting. I think I met with Michael first, which was helpful because he was not my contemporary. He was older than me, but the publisher was another generation above. And so Michael kind of vetted me, I would say, and then he went to bat for me with the publisher there. It was a husband and wife team who owned this little paper. It was published every Thursday, I believe it was. This was 1980. And yeah, they wanted to offer me the sports editor position. And I think I sort of did the fake it till you make it deal.
Covering like games at Newburgh High School.
I mean, I knew something about football because I had been a cheerleader and I had run track. And so I knew something about the spring sports. And I figured that I could learn the rest. And that's what I did for the first couple of years.
Miriam Gershow, author of Closer, 7/10/25. Miriam, welcome back. And thanks. You're looking good after a week or so with pneumonia, huh?
Thank you so much for having me. I've been sleeping a lot.
But you said the medicine's working, but the steroids have kind of a magical effect.
Thank you. They make you want to do some jumping jacks.
Right. Or lift 300-pound weights or something. You could enter the Olympics at this point. Well, when we talk for your story collection survival tips, and that was last year, you mentioned initially trying to get the book published, but didn't sell. It was a tough market for short fiction, even a collection, I should add, that became a finalist for the Oregon Book Awards in Fiction. Your agent suggested you try a novel, and that book, The Local News, took only 6 days to sell. Pretty amazing. And now 15 years later, you're back with the new novel, Closer. Though published a year after Survival Tips, I read that you actually finished Closer first. The manuscript?
I did. I finished Closer. Closer I started in 2018 and spent a couple years writing it. It didn't sell initially when I tried to sell it. And it was one of those books that I, I'm okay with letting go of books if they don't sell. I think the nature of writing, unless you're Stephen King, is that some of the books you write don't sell. But this one, I just knew this was the book I wanted to keep trying. I wanted to keep looking for a home for it. So I ended up, I had an amicable breakup with my agent when she was done selling it. And I was like, no, we need to keep going with this. And I put it away for a while. I revised it again. I kind of did everything I could to make a sale happen. And eventually I was the one that sent it out to Regal House, which is where it ended up. And they've done a really beautiful job with it. But that, I sold it 7 years after I'd written it.
You published your first novel, you mentioned Regal House, you published the first novel, Local News, with Random House, so it's a Big Five publisher. But that soured you a bit on the big commercial presses?
I mean, it feels like the world's smallest violin to say I'm soured on the Big Five. Like, the Big Five are an incredible, incredible experience. It was, I had a New York Times review, I had... on publication day, the book was on the front table of every Barnes and Noble in the country. Like, there's a distribution and marketing with Big Five that you just aren't going to get with anyone else. So I feel really, really grateful for that. But everyone warned me that if I, this, literary fiction writer from Eugene, Oregon, had a Big Five book, it might get lost in the shuffle. And it did get lost in the shuffle to an extent. So I felt like both the pros and the cons of the Big Five experience were really clear to me. I felt very, very lucky that that's what happened with my first book, but I didn't need it again because I saw those pros and cons so clearly. I think because it took so long to sell my second book, I got really clear on the fact that I just wanted to find publishers who loved the work and supported me as an author. And I let go of visions of it needs to be another Big Five book.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. On today's show, we enter the new year with an audio retrospective of last year's interviews on Jonesy. I call it Beginnings for the beginning of the new year, and the fact I'm playing only the beginnings, the first few minutes of each interview. We'll have a complete list of guests for you in the close. Lydia Yuknovich, author of Reading the Waves, 7/24/25. Well, Lydia, welcome back to KBOO. I really am so happy to be talking with you today in person.
My complete pleasure. I love talking to you too, and you know it.
Oh, thank you. Well, when we talked in January 2020 BC, and we were talking about COVID before we sat down before the mic, it was for a short story roundtable with three other great Portland-based writers, Karen Russell, Kimberly King Parsons, and Margaret Malone. We were discussing the short story in the novel, and you said, "I write in literary fragments, period. And sometimes those fragments find a place to resolve or a place to hold attention open, and those are short stories. And sometimes those fragments go on and on in my work, and they turn into novels." Is that true for memoirs like Reading the Waves?
That's a great question. I think with Reading the Waves in particular, an unusual thing happened to me in terms of form, which is I became mesmerized by, or maybe haunted by, or just, you know, really pulled, I think it's fair to say, by a different formal concept, which is return and repetition and a kind of circle or spiral pattern, which is different than what to do with fragments. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. You talk about repetition quite well. In fact, there's certain lines and words that are repeated throughout.
Many. And so it's as if, I mean, if we were talking about fragments as a form, this has a very different form in terms of keeping something in motion and keeping a return or some waves happening. But that's not to say that the fragments are gone. I think the fragment takes shape in Reading the Waves, kind of like sand at the beach. I think sediments of shells and sand and stuff from my whole life kind of resolve and dissolve in this storytelling. And that's how it seems a little bit different.
Is it kind of like a motif in music, like a Wagnerian
opera
or something? Or...
Yeah, maybe not Wagner.
Okay, not Wagner. Yeah, a little rough, but kind of hinting at the theme or playing, teasing the theme now and then.
Very much. There are words in musicology that fit what I just described for sure. Yeah.
Well, your writing's a lot like music.
To me, it is.
It's lyrical and poetic.
And that you notice that makes me feel kindred with you. I don't know if everybody notices.
I don't
that.
See how anybody can miss it. It's just beautiful
lovely.
To read. In fact, I've got several quotes here. And when I was going over them, I was saying, man, I really love reading this. You know?
How
it's
fun.
Just, it just works really well. And the funny thing was you narrated the latest version of the audiobook for Reading the Waves.
Yeah.
And I just listened to that. And you did such a great job. It was, I don't know if it works so well for fiction, but for a memoir, when the author reads it in your voice and so well, it just took on new meaning. I had already read it twice in print.
Yeah, that's interesting. I recorded that. You know, I never got the chance to record Chronology of Water in my own voice, but right when I was recording Reading the Waves, I got an offer to record Chronology of Water too. So I did them both in the same couple of months.
Is that out now then?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I just want to say out loud, it was a trip to read that older memoir and this newer thing with each other.
Side by side.
Yeah, that was a trip. I was like, holy First of all, I'm old. And secondly, you know, what a strange relationship
right.
dance they made together.
John Raymond, author of God and Sex, 8:14:25. Well, John, I'm so happy to be talking with you. I love the new book. When we were scheduling the interview, I mentioned the two films you co-wrote that are among my favorites, Old Joy and Showing Up. Both films take place in and around Portland. The new book, God and Sex, takes place in and around Ashland in Southern Oregon. So very Oregon.
Yeah, yeah.
And you grew up here in Lake Oswego?
I did, yeah. My family moved up here when I was 8 years old. That was back in 1979, so quite a while ago. Yeah, then I went to high school here, then went away for a while and came back. But at this point, yeah, I've been here way longer than almost anyone else that I meet.
Well, you're a native. That has a lot of
cachet. Close to a native, yeah.
And you've called yourself a self-professed regionalist. What appeals to you about the Pacific Northwest, Oregon in particular, as a setting for much of your work?
What appeals to me, I guess, is just that it's the card I got dealt, you know? I mean, this is the place where I grew up and where I, you know, understand the geography, where I knew people from very early age. It's the place where I, you know, went into people's houses when I was a kid and saw their families functioning or not functioning. It's the place where I did my adolescent hijinks. You know, there's just a certain way of knowing a place that that I think you have to kind of live through in a certain sense. And so it's not that I necessarily chose this out of, like, it wasn't really a choice. It was more like just
this is my home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, that said, one doesn't have to write about where they're from. One can write about, you know, pirates and leprechauns if they want to. But for me, there's just, yeah, something like politically interesting, I think, about just paying attention to what's in your backyard. And, you know, that is, you know, there are ecological politics to that, and there are, you know, personal politics and state politics. Like, there's just a kind of localism that I kind of subscribe to when it comes to paying attention to the world.
And you just have to look at your work to see you have not exhausted the possibilities of Northwest. You've said, and I quote, "I think of my relationship to the landscape as being pretty suburban for the most part, but it still functions as a relationship to nature, even though it's not totally deep in nature." And I see that in your work with characters themselves who are pretty suburban, interacting in and with nature. And as we see in God and Sex, nature can both be soothing and it can also be threatening, perhaps most dramatically, actually, in God and Sex.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it is the most catastrophic sort of representation of nature that I've done so far. I mean, the book before this, Denial, is sort of a science fiction-y, soft science fiction book.
Yeah, it takes place, I think, in 2052. It
takes place in 2052 and is sort of post global Green New Deal. And so there has been some major environmental reckoning in that one. And certainly fires are existing in the near margins of that book. But this one, not to give too much away, but like there is a forest fire that is pretty protracted and threatening in it. And, you know, I mean, sadly, that's just like sort of a form of realism at this point. You know?
Exactly.
I mean,
we go through it here.
Yeah,
with wildfires.
Totally. And it's a annual or biannual trauma that we all are kind of dealing with, and that collectively we've chosen not to do anything about, in a sense, that, you know, rather than address some of the root causes of this stuff, I guess we're just going to armor ourselves and our cities to the point where we just endure this.
Mo Davio, author of Epic and Lovely, 8:28:25. Well, Mo, while reading your bio, I have to say one thing that caught my eye as someone with a passion for radio.
Mm-hmm.
You were a DJ on the Smith College radio station WOZQ when you were a student there?
That is absolutely correct. And it was probably my favorite part of college was being part of WOZQ. Do you remember the night of the Oscars in 1998?
Oh, no. What was the event?
Elliot Smith was nominated
for best song for Good Will Hunting.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, he plays a big part in your first book.
He Every does. Anxious Wave. And that night, because none of the other DJs wanted to miss the show, I DJed for like 8 hours.
On Oscar night.
On Oscar night, I just played a ton of Elliot. And yeah, I was hardcore. I was really enamored with the indie scene and had been since I was 11 years old.
And when, you're in the right city for that now. Huh? We idolize them here in Portland.
That's part of why I'm here. when I was 11, I lived in Fresno, California. And one day I discovered the Fresno State radio station. And that was absolutely life-changing for a too tall, nerdy 11-year-old girl who got bullied all the time.
Man, radios work that way. There's talk about people who, they grew up in some small town, and at night they're getting like stations from New York and Chicago. Mm-hmm. There's even a Lou Reed song, Rock and Roll.
Yeah. And this would have been 1987, so there was no internet yet. But I found KFSR, and I want to say thank you to whoever those DJs were back then who would take my phone calls and ask me I would ask them about music. That's how I learned about They Might Be Giants and the Pixies and. It just went from there.
That was a different time when, some stations were not as freeform, but the ones where they let the DJs play what they wanted to play, it's much different than a Spotify or an Amazon Music or an Apple Music, because that's all determined by algorithm based on your other interests, where a DJ is going to introduce you to new music you had no idea existed.
Right.
And it might click with you like...
Yeah. This was the era where all the girls my age loved New Kids on the Block. And I, even then, couldn't see it. I didn't think they were cute. I didn't like the music.
But... Oh, well, I got to ask you also for the WOZQ station ID DJ Mo voice.
This is WOZQ 91.9 FM, Northampton. I'm Monique, as I was known back then. You just heard...
Elliot Smith.
Elliot Smith with
And
Angelus.
We're about to hear some more Elliot Smith.
We just got an amazing new album in called In the Aeroplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel. Yeah.
Wow, great. You've got the voice.
I do have the voice.
You're natural.
Yeah.
Lainey Zumas, author of Wolf Bells, 10-9-25. Well, Lainey, Wolf Bells is your fourth book and third novel, following Red Clocks, which came out in 2018. That book was a bestseller and widely praised, deservedly so. The new novel took you about 7 years to write. I'm just wondering if the success, the overwhelming success, actually, of Red Clocks made the writing any more challenging or stressful.
That's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that before.
I always try for those. I don't always succeed.
Well, you got it this time.
Thanks.
I think, since Red Clocks was my third book, but it was the first one that got me some national attention and more readers. And I think that definitely contributed to my sense when I was writing Wolf Bells of not that it would be a successful book, but that it would have a few readers. And whereas when I was writing the first three books, that was not even in my mind, it's like maybe some people, a couple people will read it. So I think that was a little challenging, actually, because it also, in the years since Red Clocks came out, because of all the horrific stuff that's been going on around reproductive rights in the United States, I would sometimes be contacted by people asking my thoughts, my take, my opinion. And I do have opinions, of course, on all the ways that reproductive justice is being demolished in our country today. And I'm a novelist and not a political orator or I don't write op-eds and although maybe I will one day. It was kind of an interesting, I'm not saying it was a bad thing, but it was sort of being put or being invited into a role that I hadn't been in before. And of course, it made me think more about the political tendrils and ramifications of what I was writing about in Wolf Bells.
Yeah, that actually leads to my next question. It was written during a time when legal abortion was under siege, Red Clocks, and that sparked the world building you do in the book, Near Future U.S., where there's a parenthood amendment that grants rights to every embryo. There's a pink wall that prevents women from coming from the U.S. to get abortions in Canada. Abortions and abortion attempts are harshly punished. That book now seems sadly prescient, though in hindsight, you didn't take that big of a leap at the time.
No, I mean, because also, I mean, the Personhood Amendment, which I kind of stumbled upon back in like 2010, 2011, 2012, when I started not only researching Red Clocks, but researching IVF, because that was something I was going through personally, infertility treatment. And I found things by, you know, Mike Pence and Paul Ryan supporting this thing called the Personhood Amendment, because it not only would ban abortion and make it illegal to both for doctors and patients, but also it would ban in vitro fertilization because the embryos had not given their consent to be moved out of their home in the uterus or the so
it sounds awfully ridiculous now, doesn't it? Yeah. That these people actually believe that.
Yeah, yeah, it does. And so at the time, I was really fascinated by that and, of course, wanted to bring it into the book. I never thought at all. I mean, it never occurred to me that it would become a viable political possibility, but it is now. There's a lot of states that have personhood amendments either, you know, people are really trying to bring them to votes and bring them into state assemblies.
Gigi Little, author of Who Killed Won the Gun, 10-23-25. Well, Gigi, we've talked for the radio many times, but I never got too far into your own story. So let's go back a few years. Where did you grow up? I guess that's going back quite a few years.
Yeah.
And what was your family like?
Oh, gosh. I grew up in mostly Southern California, except that I born in D.C. and actually lived in Australia for 3 years when I was a very small child, too small to really remember. But yeah, California from when I was like six onward, and have a wonderful family. When I was first studying writing in Dangerous Writing with Tom Spanbauer, you write a lot about your own story, and there was a lot of like dysfunctional family stuff. And
I encounter that all the time in
right?
author interviews. Yeah.
And I was writing a book for my own story. And the family was great. And everybody's like, that's not realistic. You know, yeah, it's a great, I have a great family, fam.
Now you mentioned as a kid, this was at your Powell's launch. You had your own world made of toys, and you called it Little Town, which has a double meaning. So pretty clever for a kid.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of that when I was a kid, yeah.
So you had your own kind of simulated city there.
Yeah.
Like SimCity, the video game, pre-video games.
Pre-Sim. Yeah, I, my brother and sister, my cousin, my friends, we all had a town. And I was the one who started it. And so I got to have the clever name based on my last name, but it was my cousin followed suit with Tiny Town. That's not her last name, though.
No, but you could give her that nickname.
Yeah, yes, I should have.
Now, I've known for a while that you ran away with the circus, mm-hmm. I think as a teenager, but I don't know much more than that, so this is a great opportunity to satisfy my excessive curiosity. Was it Toby Tyler or Something Wicked This Way Comes?
Probably more Toby Tyler than Something Wicked, for sure. I married into it. My ex was a clown and a ringmaster, and I became a clown, and I was in the business for 15 years.
Did you train as a clown then?
I did not.
Oh.
He did not either, actually. His dad
was a
clown,
natural.
Too.
Oh.
He was a natural.
So he had it in the genes.
Yes, and I was not a natural. I was not. I was not good. I wanted to be. It was very exciting and very, very colorful and very cool at first, but I was not. I don't think I was very funny.
Brandon Wong, author of Gloria Benrostro Is Not My Girlfriend, 11-13-25. Well, Brandon, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios.
Thanks for having me. This is wonderful. What a dream come true. This has been a wonderful, wonderful location and a lot of wonderful studios. Thank you.
Yeah, we've had it for a long time. We're lucky because this area has been gentrified. So KBOO owns the building, but I think we would have been kicked out by a much more expensive lease by now. So it worked out. Now you're from the Portland area. You were born just across the Columbia in Vancouver, and you're of Vietnamese heritage. What's your family background, and how did your parents or maybe grandparents get to the U.S., emigrate?
Yeah, my family are refugees from the war. My father came over when he was a teenager, and they immigrated to Camas, Washington, and that's where he met my mother in high school, because he was one of a group of teenagers that immigrated from Vietnam.
And was that a kind of a tricky escape at the time? I've known several people I've worked with who barely got out.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I actually only just recently learned their story about how they came over. Very typical Vietnamese fashion. I didn't learn about this growing up. It was never really a story that was told to me.
They didn't talk about it.
They didn't talk about it. It really took a long time to kind of pull those stories out of them. My father didn't know that he was even escaping when he did. I have a lot of aunts and uncles, and my grandparents at the time agreed upon that they were going to tell the older siblings that what was really happening. They were leaving the country, and they were going to not tell the younger siblings what was happening. So all my father knew, he was at the cutoff right in the middle. All my father knew was, get dressed like you're going to a party, and then we're going to, and they basically, he just wore what, you know, a nice shirt, some slacks, and he thought he was going to a dinner party. And what ended up happening was they got to an airfield, boarded a plane, and they went to the Philippines.
Wow.
Yeah.
What an escape.
To get out.
Yeah, a friend of mine who I work with got out on a very risky escape by boat.
Yeah.
And there were, of course, a lot of people on the boat trying to get out. And boy, he barely made it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are so many of those boat stories that are harrowing, terrifying tales. And it truly is a miracle that people had made it, those journeys. Yeah.
So you're first generation of your family born in America.
Yeah.
Ah. And we talked about this before we got before the mics, but living in this area, you discovered Powell's books.
Yeah.
As a kid, and you hung out in the children's list section. Was that the start, Brandon, of your love for reading and writing?
Yeah, it really was. Like I said, my weekends, there's so much more variety now than when I was a kid, but to get, you know, good Vietnamese food, you had to go into Portland to do it. You had to go, you know, travel Sandy to the pho restaurants, and you got to go over there. So a lot of my weekends that was the routine. I would go into Portland, meet up with my uncle and my cousins, and we'd have a bowl of pho, and then we'd go, hey, let's go to Powell's. Let's go hit up Powell's. And that was the thing. So I would spend a lot of my weekends was cruising the Rose Room, and there were no rules. It was kind of, you know, here's some money. Pick what you want. So I spent a lot of time at Powell's.
Oh, that's great. So your family kind of encouraged you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It was Powell's was a big place I went to. And then every the holidays, I was always gifted at least one book. And it usually was my dad didn't really know what,
you know,
kids read, but he always grabbed the, you know, probably a Newbery Honor, a Newbery Medalist, right? Yeah, he was, or some kind of classic book. So that's, yeah, he really fueled my love of reading just by like taking me to Powell's and also gifting me those books during the holiday season.
Amy Mason Doan, author of The California Dreamers, 12/11/25. Amy, I so enjoyed the book, which brought me back to my high school days in Los Angeles. We were city kids, so headed to the Santa Monica Pier almost every summer to body surf. Not exactly the traditional surf culture, but it was cheap and easy for us. My girlfriend, however, and this was first and second year of college, she lived down in Southern California, but in Corona Del Mar, which was definitely board surfing world. So I got a taste of it through her and, of course, through listening to the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean. That was her culture, her life, a little different from me. But you grew up in Danville, California, so that's inland.
Very inland.
About 20 miles east of Oakland, about 35 miles from the Pacific Ocean.
Yep. Yep.
I'm guessing you were not a surfer.
I wasn't. I was not. I was actually born in Merced, California. Talk about inland.
Even more inland
and very far from the world of this book. Very inland, very suburban, very rooted, and very traditional. So again, unlike anything the family in Dreamers is like. But I read and I watched movies and I loved Gidget. I did. Loved it. Will defend it forever. I love Sandra Dee and everything about it. So I was fascinated by surfing, and I had a lot of friends who did surf.
and would go to Santa Cruz. And it was a trek from Danville when I was a teenager to Santa Cruz to surfing. But I think I was always interested, even though my world was so different, it was intriguing to me. And I think the book kind of captures that as much as the insider perspective. It kind of touches on this idea of the California dream, right?
Yes.
Surfing is a dream, and surfing is something that outsiders kind of wonder about and worship and are curious about, or maybe enraged by. Maybe it.
No, that right? was even true when I was a kid.
Yeah, right.
Well, certainly living in the Los Angeles city proper.
Right.
And again, the Beach Boys and all that, and summer fun, and of course, Gidget movies, and there yep. was a whole bunch of. Beach bikini movies.
Beach bikini movies.
And surfers.
And then what did they represent, right? To some people, maybe older people, it was like youth, and it was, but for some, this was the dream, right? And,
yeah.
And I think it was for me too. I think there was that here's little nerdy Amy reading Jane Eyre, you know, in Danville inside, not even in the sun. You know, I wasn't one of those teenagers in the 80s who was out slathering myself with, you know, Bandage of Soleil or baby oil. I was inside reading.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. We just heard an audio retrospective of last year's interviews on the show, which I call beginnings for the beginning of the new year and the fact we're playing only the beginnings, the first few minutes of each interview. If you missed any part of the show, or you'd like to hear the full interviews, not just the beginnings, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to all our guests in 2025, Sarah Neidhart and Wendy McPhee, Jeremy Braddock and David Osman, Karen Russell, Elizabeth Heider, Laura Stanfill, Elaine Pagels, Nancy Townsley, Miriam Gershow, Lydia Yuknovich, John Raymond, Mo Davio, Lainey Zumas, Gigi Little, Brandon Wong, and Amy Mason Doe. In that respect, at least, it was a very good year. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday morning, January 22nd at 10:30. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, wishing you all a new year of peace, love, and joy. May we all live in less interesting times.